and read some of the scribbled messages. Saskia, no need to throw yourself down the stairs just to get out of the Eastgate project. Get well soon. Malcolm. Thinking of you, Saskia. We'll be in to visit soon. Lots of love. Nina. Kiss, kiss. Dear Saskia, you poor thing. Keep your spirits up. JD. I'll be in with chocolate brownies on Saturday. Is there anything you need us to pick up for you? Said Kate, who was helping herself to a second chocolate. I remember you saying that your family is in Tasmania, so... She glanced briefly at Lance as if she was worried she was saying the wrong thing. Lance cleared his throat awkwardly and looked up at the blank television screen next to my bed. Kate kept talking. My family is in Brisbane, so I understand what it's like, you know. Other people have sisters and mothers and cousins and whatnot. Really, it's no trouble. I stared at them. At Lance. He had kind, sleepy eyes and big shoulders as if he worked out. I don't think I'd ever properly looked at him before. I looked at his wife. She was extremely thin and flat-chested. Gamine, my mother would have called her, with very short hair and big eyes like a woodland creature. She was sitting at a strange angle on the chair, still eating my chocolates. Maybe I did remember talking to her at the Christmas party, about a holiday she'd taken to Cradle Mountain. I'd left the party early to sit outside Patrick's house in my car. I saw him come home and carry Jack inside, asleep on his shoulder, his head lolling. I thought of Jack again and his broken arm, and Ellen telling me that I should move away from Sydney. And what would these two nice people visiting me think if they knew what I'd done last night, what I'd been doing for the last 3 years? And I felt a plummeting sensation. It's a shock, isn't it, when something like this happens? Said Kate. Your life is going along one way, and then wham, you get thrown a curveball. She jerked her head to demonstrate herself avoiding a curveball, and half the chocolates went flying from the open box on her lap. Kate, said Lance. He crouched down to pick up the chocolates. Oops, said Kate. I'm not, I was trying to say. You don't understand. You think I'm a normal person like you, but I'm not. The words dried up. It was as if my entire personality had disintegrated. I was still breathing, my heart still beating, but I was no longer here. The brisk, professional Saskia that Lance had known and the crazy Saskia that Patrick had known had both vanished. I had no idea what sort of person I was. Funny or serious, quiet or loud. If I stopped wanting Patrick, what did I want? What was I interested in? Did I exist at all? These two odd, sweet people were looking at me as if I did exist, but my very existence seemed questionable. Boogie boarding, I said suddenly. Oh, yes, said Kate amiably, as if that was a perfectly normal thing to say out of the blue. I thought Nina said you fell down a flight of stairs, Lance frowned. She said you were walking in your sleep. I had no memory of telling Nina that, but it was logical. Boogie boarding is an interest of mine, I said, and then I thought, did I just say that out loud? Me too, said Kate. Well, not that I've ever actually been boogie boarding, but I'd like to try it. Or, well, to be accurate, I'd really like to try proper surfing on a proper surfboard. I'd be meaning to have lessons. Lance snorted and Kate slapped him on the arm and looked at me brightly. Looks like they've got you on some pretty good painkillers, have they then, Saskia? Said Lance. Don't be rude, said Kate. She's making perfect sense. I didn't say she wasn't, said Lance. Whose phone is that? Said Kate. I recognized the sound of my mobile phone. Kate lifted up my leather bag. Should I answer it? I looked at the bag. How is it possible that I still had my bag after all that had happened? For some reason, it struck me as amusing that I still had my bag. I laughed out loud. I really want some of what you're having, said Lance. I'll answer it. Kate burrowed in my bag and pulled out the phone. She didn't say she wanted it answered, said Lance. Saskia's phone. Kate stood up and walked away from the hospital bed with my phone pressed to her ear. I heard her say, Well, yes, she is here, but... Now, don't worry, she's fine. It's just that she's actually in the hospital at the moment. Sorry, said Lance. Kate can be a bit... He shrugged, unable to find the right word to describe his wife. Sure you don't want a chocolate? All right, I said. I took a chocolate and watched Kate chatting animatedly. A few minutes later, she came back and put the phone next to my bedside table. That was your friend Tammy, she said. You were meant to be meeting her for a drink tonight? Anyway, she's on her way here. I gave her directions. We should get going. Lance slapped his hands to his knees and half rose from his chair. We don't want to tire you out, Saskia. I guess we should. Kate looked at her watch. Although we've got plenty of time. We could wait until Tammy gets here if you want the company, Saskia. I had every intention of saying something like, Oh, you'd better not miss your movie, but the words that came out of my mouth were, Please stay. Of course, said Lance and Kate at the same time. It was early evening and Ellen's house was unexpectedly full of people. Patrick's parents and brother had come over to sign Jack's cast and give him get-well gifts, and to Ellen's mild irritation, although she couldn't explain why, so had her own mother. Anne had given Jack the book of Guinness World Records, which had proved to be a huge hit. They were all crammed around Ellen's dining room table eating sausages that Patrick had cooked on the barbecue. Patrick had come back from the police station in a better frame of mind. The police had praised him for his stalking incident log, a ring folder full of meticulously kept records of Saskia's actions over the last 3 years, including printouts of emails, letters, and descriptions of incidents. Ellen had flipped through it, marveling at Patrick's terse comments. 12:30 a.m., 27th of July. S banged on front door, demanding entry, ignoring repeated requests to leave. Patrick had been told that an interim apprehended violence order would be issued, and that Saskia would be given the option to appear in court to contest it. She would also most likely be charged with trespass. It seemed that this time, whoever had been on the desk at Patrick's local police station had given Patrick exactly the right level of respectful, authoritative sympathy. He was no longer seething. He had the look of a man who was finally about to be vindicated after a long fight for justice. Ellen had her mobile phone on the sideboard within hearing distance. She was waiting for a phone call from Mary Kate, who was going to try to get the newspaper article stopped. Ellen wasn't holding out much hope. It seemed highly unlikely that Mary Kate, stodgy, morose Mary Kate, would be able to take on someone as powerful and shiny-toothed as Ian Roman. I'm not making any promises, Mary Kate had said, after she'd listened to Ellen's story, using a small leather notebook to take down cursory, decisive notes. But as soon as I leave here, I'll file for an interlocutory injunction. There's not a chance in hell we'll get one. The courts have this thing about freedom of speech, so you basically can't ever get one. But I'm aiming to convince the Daily News lawyers that we will. It's clear the story is motivated by malice, and sounds like it'd really flush your reputation down the toilet. But anyway, I'll go in tough.
I thought you were a legal secretary, said Ellen faintly.
Nope, said Mary Kate, most unbarristerish. A memory resurfaced now of Mary Kate saying she worked in the legal profession. Ellen had just assumed she was a legal secretary. Would she have been more patient and respectful with Mary Kate if she'd known she was dealing with a barrister? Shamefully, the answer was yes.
Do you know the world record for the most broken bones? Said Jack now.
He had the Guinness World Records book open on the table next to him and was turning the pages while he ate. He didn't wait for anyone to answer.
35. Some dude called Evel Knievel.
Really? I didn't think we had that many bones, said Maureen.
She was acting particularly interested in the book to show that she didn't mind that Jack had put aside her gift for Anne's.
We've actually got 206 bones, said Anne.
Well, fancy that,
Maureen smiled fiercely.
Babies have around 300 bones. They fuse together as they grow, said Anne.
It must have been a wonderful thing bringing up a child with your medical expertise, said Maureen. I was always bundling them into the car to take them off to the doctor and then feeling like a fool when there was nothing wrong.
Please don't be condescending, Mum, thought Ellen.
Actually, I think it made it worse.
To Ellen's relief, the smile Anne gave Maureen had only minimal queenliness. I knew everything that could go wrong. Every temperature meant certain death.
Speaking of temperatures, said Patrick's father, well, not temperatures so much, but aches. I've had this really strange ache in my...
Dad, said Patrick.
George refuses to make an appointment to see a doctor, said Maureen. But whenever he meets one, he starts telling them about his medical problems.
I just thought she'd find it interesting, said George.
Would you find it interesting if people started talking to you about their electrical problems? Said Maureen.
I certainly would, said George. Blown any fuses lately, Anne?
So, anyway, it must have been nice for you, Ellen, growing up with a mother who was a doctor, said Maureen.
Mum, said Patrick.
What?
Patrick shrugged and took a bite of his sausage sandwich.
She was always sort of cranky with me when I got sick, said Ellen.
Our mum was exactly the same, spoke up Patrick's brother. The angriest I've ever seen Mum was the time I got knocked out by a cricket ball. I come to, and the first thing I see is Mum, and she's yelling, Simon, wake up this minute!
I thought he was dead, said Maureen.
So you thought yelling at me would bring me back to life?
I understand completely, said Anne. The fear makes you furious.
You'll understand when you have your baby, Ellen, said Maureen.
Ellen, who was actually looking forward to being the very opposite of her own mother, and fondly imagined herself soothing her child's feverish brow with a gentle, cool hand, said, I'm sure I will.
Dad wasn't mad at me when I broke my arm, said Jack. He was mad at Saskia.
There was an instant strained silence around the table.
That's because it was Saskia's fault, said Patrick.
It was an accident, said Jack. Actually, you were sort of pushing her. Yes, darling, it was an accident. But what your dad means is that Saskia should not have been here in the middle of the night, said Maureen.
How did you go with the police? Said George to Patrick.
You told the police about Saskia? Jack's head whipped around to look accusingly at his father. She's not going to jail, is she?
She won't go to jail, said Patrick. But you understand, mate, she can't break into our house again. The police will just tell her that she can't come anywhere near us anymore.
Right, but I guess she'll still come and watch me play soccer, though, said Jack.
Ellen drew in her breath. Good Lord, said George.
What are you talking about, Jack?
Patrick carefully placed his sausage sandwich back on the plate in front of him. She watches all my games, said Jack.
I've never seen her there, said Patrick.
You've got bad eyes, said Jack dismissively. She stands way off, near a tree or whatever. She always wears this blue knitted hat, like a pancake.
Beret, murmured Anne.
Goodness, I think I knitted it for her, said Maureen.
If I see her anywhere near you again, I'll have her arrested, said Patrick.
You will not, said Jack.
I will.
If you do, I will never speak to you again.
Fine, said Patrick.
Don't.
Boys.
Maureen held out her hands to each of them helplessly. Ellen's phone began to ring. I'll just... Excuse me. She rushed into the kitchen with the phone. Mary Kate?
Yes, hi, Ellen. Right, they're holding off on publication. The journalist has agreed to hear your side of the story first. And I get the impression she's ready to drop the whole thing. Most journalists do have integrity, and this one is hating the idea that Ian Roman could be using her for some personal vendetta, even if Ian Roman does rule her world.
Ellen felt her whole body sag with relief. Thank you, she said. I can't thank you enough, Mary-Kate.
No problem, said Mary-Kate.
Ellen heard the deep rumble of a man's voice in the background.
By the way, Alfred says to say hi.
Alfred? Said Ellen. Alfred Boyle?
Mary-Kate chuckled. Ellen didn't think she'd ever heard her laugh before. Don't pretend to be so surprised, Ellen.
Ellen laughed, a little nervously.
Alfred said to tell you that he gave a speech to 200 accountants today, and he had them in stitches. That's really saying something. He made accountants laugh.
That's great, said Ellen.
I'll be in touch about where we go next with this, said Mary-Kate. But I expect once the journalist and the editor know the full story, it'll be shelved.
You'll have to bill me for your work, said Ellen. Didn't barristers charge by the minute?
Don't be ridiculous, said Mary-Kate joyfully, and then she abruptly hung up.
Ellen dropped her head, closed her eyes, and tapped the phone against her forehead. So her matchmaking with Mary-Kate and Alfred had paid off. She must remember to tell the journalist about it if she ever got to speak to her again. Clinical hypnotherapist hypnotizes her patients to fall in love with each other. That would really add to her credibility.
Everything okay?
Ellen opened her eyes. Her mother was standing in front of her, holding a salad bowl.
Thought I'd start clearing up. It's getting a bit tense in there.
Not surprised. This Saskia is clearly deranged.
Saskia is finished with us, said Ellen. I talked to her today.
Hypnotized her, did you?
Said Anne smartly, but automatically, as if she was just doing it out of habit, and before Ellen could answer, she put the bowl down on the table and said,
Listen, I need to talk to you about something. About your father.
You're getting married, guessed Ellen. She could just imagine the discreetly elegant wedding. Her mother would wear violet to match her eyes. There would be designer labels galore, flutes of champagne held between manicured fingers. It would be the sort of wedding that made it into the society pages. Ellen's face would ache from faking her smile.
Will you have Pip and Mel as bridesmaids? She said. I could be flower girl. Your daughter as your flower girl. Your cute little pregnant flower girl.
Ellen, my stepbrothers could be page boys. Giant page boys. We broke up.
Oh, no.
The one time Ellen was enjoying being a bitch and it was entirely inappropriate and hurtful. And in fact, she would have been perfectly happy for her parents to be married. Their wedding would have been moving and lovely. What was wrong with her?
What happened? She asked.
He went back to his wife, of course. Or he moved on to a younger model. Or was it somehow Ellen's fault? Did he not like Ellen? Ah, listen to the inner child piping up for attention.
I broke it off, said Anne.
She sat down at the kitchen table and extracted a cherry tomato from the salad bowl.
But why?
Ellen pulled out a chair and sat down opposite her mother.
You seemed... Well, you seemed completely besotted.
I know, said her mother. She looked at Ellen and gave a little half-smile and shrugged.
I was. Look, I'm utterly mortified.
Ellen was momentarily distracted by the sound of Patrick's voice rising in the dining room.
Can we please talk about something else other than Saskia? Like, I don't know, Armageddon? Who wants to talk about Armageddon?
You don't need to feel embarrassed, she said to her mother.
I've been such a twit, said Anne. With everything you've got going on in your life at the moment...
She inclined her head toward the dining room.
Getting married, new stepson, baby on the way, deranged stalker and what have you, and I decide to throw your father into the mix.
Mum, I'm a grown-up, said Ellen gravely, and extremely fraudulently, seeing as she'd thought exactly the same thing. Tell me why you broke it off.
I've spent the last 35 years being in love with a memory, said Anne. It's crazy, and I would have denied it, but every time I went out with anyone, I was comparing him to your father.
Your father, whom I never actually dated, whom I really didn't even know that well. So of course every man came up short, she giggled, in more ways than one.
Mother, Ellen recoiled, please.
Sorry.
So when David and I started dating again, I was deliriously happy. He was every bit as lovely as I recalled.
Actually, let me make this clear. He is lovely. He still qualifies as the loveliest man I've ever met.
So what's the problem? Said Ellen. Well, I started noticing this feeling creeping over me after we'd spent more than an hour together. At first I couldn't put a name to it, and then last week it hit me. I was bored.
Bored, said Ellen. She was suddenly feeling very sorry for her father.
Bored out of my mind, confirmed Anne.
Well, but that can happen.
No, said Anne decidedly. He's not right for me. He never was right for me. He doesn't have enough to say. And he has these periods of time where he literally does nothing. The other morning, he sat in an armchair for 20 minutes, literally 20 minutes, without doing anything. Not reading, not talking, just staring at a tree. What's that about?
Perhaps he was silently contemplating the beauty of nature, offered Ellen. Or just taking a few moments to meditate and be thankful for his life. Or he was practicing mindfulness.
It was a rhetorical question, Ellen. Honestly, I thought he'd lost brain function. Anyway, as the young people say so eloquently, whatever. I don't care what he's doing, I just know it drives me nuts.
We will be friends, of course. It's all perfectly amicable. And he says that he would love to see you again, if you'd like that.
That would be nice, said Ellen.
Actually, the thought of meeting up with her father now seemed perfectly acceptable, even quite soothing. She thought of rainy Sunday afternoons as a child when she would lie on a rug on the floor, mesmerized by the raindrops sliding down the window pane.
and her mother would keep walking in and out of the room saying, "Ellen, what are you doing? Let's go out. Let's talk. Let's do something." Perhaps she and her father could linger together without the need to say a word. No need for awkward getting-to-know-you conversations. They could just be father and daughter. And if they didn't feel a thing for each other except a mild friendliness, then that would be perfectly fine. "So, at the tender age of 66, said Anne, "I might be finally ready for a real relationship, now that I can let go of my silly obsession with a romance that never really was. I might even do a little online shopping for a new man. Apparently it's the latest thing for the over 60s. And look how successful it's been for you." "Yes," said Ellen. He would never love another woman as much as he loved Colleen. Maybe not that successful. "Speaking of which," Anne lowered her voice, "I've been meaning for a while to say that I've become very fond of Patrick. Really, very fond. I took some time to warn to him." "He's right there," hissed Ellen. "Well, that's okay. I'm saying nice things about him. I like the way he looks at you. You're right. John was entertaining, but he didn't look at you the way Patrick looks at you." "How does Patrick look at me?" asked Ellen. "And he's a good father." "Am I interrupting?" Ellen and her mother turned to see Maureen at the door, with her arms full of plates. "I was just saying what a good father your son is." Anne stood up and took some of the plates from her. Maureen beamed. There was a sound of running footsteps and they heard Jack scream, "I hate you!" "Fine," shouted back Patrick. "Break your other arm for all I care." Maureen's beam wavered. She got it back under control and began scraping leftover food from the plates with the edge of a knife. "This windy weather really puts people on edge, doesn't it? I wonder, is there a medical reason for that, Anne?" I must have fallen asleep because it seemed like I just blinked my eyes and Tammy had materialized. She and Lance and Kate were sitting in a little semicircle of chairs next to my bed, eating chocolates. Tammy had changed her hair from long and dark to short and strawberry blonde. A mistake, I thought. Lance and Tammy were talking excitedly to each other in peculiar accents, shrugging their shoulders and jutting out their chins. "They're trying to talk like Baltimore drug dealers," explained Kate when she saw I'd woken up. "They've discovered they're both obsessed with The Wire. Some weekends, Lance talks like that for an entire day. Can you imagine? I mean, fine, if he actually did sound like a drug dealer, that might be quite sexy." "Tammy?" I said. "Saskia, honey!" She stood up and leaned over to kiss me on the cheek. She must have still been using the same fragrance as she had 3 years ago, because I was immediately taken back to a different time and place. "It's so good to see you," she said. "But you're meant to be sitting next to me in a bar, not lying in a hospital bed. Lance and Kate said you were sleepwalking and fell down some stairs? That's terrible. How long have you been sleepwalking for?" "Since I last saw you," I said mysteriously, the sort of profound comment that Ellen would appreciate, but Tammy took it at face value. "Really? Is there a cure? You know, I was thinking on the way here about the last time I saw you. You'd just had your heart broken by some guy, that surveyor? What was his name? Pete? Patrick? It's been so long you probably don't even remember the guy." Oh, how I laughed. "Ellen!" It was Patrick shouting from the second floor. "Goodness, is he all right?" said Ellen's mother, startled. "I expect he needs your help working things out with Jack," said Maureen to Ellen. "A woman's touch, you know." She gave Anne a you-know-what-I-mean smile, which was totally lost on Anne. Ellen dried her hands briskly on a tea towel, bustling a little for Anne's benefit because she knew it would bug her to see her behaving so housewifely, and hurried upstairs to Jack's room. Patrick and Jack were sitting on the floor, their backs up against Jack's single bed with its Ben 10 bedspread, their hands dangling between their propped-up knees, not looking at each other. "Can you explain to this stubborn kid why Saskia can't break into our house in the middle of the night?" said Patrick to Ellen when he saw her standing at the doorway. He mouthed silently, "Help." "I'm not stupid, Dad," said Jack hotly. "I know she shouldn't have done that." "Right, good then. So what's the problem?" said Patrick. "Why are you so mad with me?" Ellen went and sat on the floor next to them. She looked at Jack's skinny, vulnerable little legs in tracksuit pants stuck out in front of him. She said, "How did you feel when your dad and Saskia broke up, Jack?" Jack and Patrick both went very still, as if she'd brought up something deeply shameful. For heaven's sake, thought Ellen. She felt filled with feistiness. Everything might as well be out in the open now. There would be no more pussyfooting around the subject of Saskia.
"Well, that's not," began Patrick.
"I'd like to know," said Ellen. "You asked for my help, buddy."
"I don't really remember," said Jack. "I was really little, like 5.
He gazed ahead, looking back over the vast expanse of time that separated 5 from 8.
"That's right, you were very little." Patrick gave Ellen a triumphant look. "So the point is..."
"Oh yeah, I remember one thing," interrupted Jack. "I thought it had to do with her lucky marble."
Patrick's face changed.
"What?"
Jack banged his knuckles against the cast on his arm.
"Her lucky marble?" asked Ellen.
Patrick answered her, his eyes on Jack as he spoke.
"She had this big, colourful marble that belonged to her father, and she held it in the palm of her hand whenever she was nervous about something. She gave it to Jack when he started school."
He paused and cleared his throat. "She said to carry it in his pocket and the marble would give him magic powers."
"It wasn't a weapon," clarified Jack, and he looked up at Ellen. "It didn't transform into a laser gun or anything like that. It didn't really do anything at all, actually."
"I took Saskia's lucky marble with me when I saw my first ever Scott Surveys client," said Patrick. "I held it while I waited in reception."
He'd never before referred to a nice memory involving Saskia. It was Ellen's first glimpse of the other side of their story.
"I lost the marble at school," said Jack. "I looked and looked, and a teacher tried to help me, but we couldn't find it. I didn't want to tell Saskia because I knew she'd be sad, and then the next day she was gone. So I thought, uh-oh, she found out I lost it."
Patrick's eyes met Ellen's over the top of Jack's head.
"You thought it was your fault," said Ellen to Jack. "I thought she must have been so mad at me," said Jack. "And I thought Dad was mad at me for making her go, and that's why we couldn't talk about her."
"Oh, mate." Patrick pressed 2 fingers to his forehead. "You didn't."
"Yeah, I did," said Jack cheerfully.
"But it was absolutely nothing to do with you." Patrick's eyes were glistening. He went to put his arm around Jack's shoulders. "Mate, Saskia loved you. She would have done anything for you. She..." Jack shrugged his father's arm away.
"Take a chill pill, Dad. I know it wasn't my fault. You and Saskia broke up like Ethan's parents did. I was telling you what I thought when I was a dumb little kid."
He yawned.
"Anyway, I might go and look at my Guinness World Records book again."
"We haven't finished talking," protested Patrick.
Jack rolled his eyes.
"Whatever.
I just want to make sure you understand."
"You don't have to be so mean about her."
Jack went to fold his arms and then realized he couldn't because of his cast.
"That's all I want to say. You act like she's an actual murderer of actual people. She didn't break my arm on purpose. It was an accident."
"Yeah," said Patrick tiredly. "I know, mate, you're right. But it's complicated."
"Hey, guys." Patrick's brother appeared at Jack's doorway. "I've got to get going, meeting some friends."
Jack took Simon's arrival as his opportunity to escape back downstairs.
"See ya,"
he said, giving his uncle a high five on the way out.
"You two look totally trashed."
Simon shook his head in wonder before heading back downstairs.
"Thanks so much,"
Ellen called after him. Patrick stood up and gave his hand to Ellen to haul her up. She grunted,
"Ugh, I feel trashed."
Patrick pulled her to him and she rested her head against his chest for a moment. Her head swirled.
Poor little Jack thinking it was his fault.
Poor Saskia losing her lucky marble.
Poor David being dumped by Mum for being boring.
Poor me because Patrick doesn't really love me and I'm having a teeny tiny baby and, oh my God in heaven, my breasts hurt.
"Everything is going to be fine," said Patrick quietly in her ear.
"Is it?" she said.
When they got downstairs, they found Anne had given up on her half-hearted attempt to help Patrick's mother and was sitting at the kitchen table drinking a glass of wine while Maureen kept packing the dishwasher.
"Well, I have to dash," she said when she saw Ellen. "Pip and Mel and I are meeting up for a drink. There's a new wine bar in the city we've been meaning to try."
"You're going into the city now?"
Maureen looked at the clock on Ellen's kitchen wall. It was 8 p.m.
"Goodness."
"Oh, we three are night owls," said Anne.
It was like her interlude with Ellen's father had never happened. His appearance hadn't been a giant upheaval in Ellen's life at all, just an odd little ripple. Anne ended up leaving together with Simon, who coincidentally was meeting friends at a club on the same street as Anne's wine bar, and was thrilled to save on cab money into the city.
"Well, that's just so nice of you, Anne," said Maureen unhappily.
After Ellen and Maureen had finished clearing up the kitchen, Ellen's kitchen cabinets hadn't been so sparklingly clean since before her grandmother had died. Patrick's father suggested a game of Monopoly. He'd spotted the box sitting on Ellen's grandmother's shelf and was rubbing his hands and promising to bankrupt them all within the hour. While George was setting up the board, carefully stacking banknotes into neat piles, Patrick asked if he and Ellen could be excused from the game.
"We might take a quick walk on the beach," he said, raising his eyebrows questioningly at Ellen. She nodded. Maybe that would clear her head.
"It's a cold, windy night in the middle of winter and in the middle of the night," protested Maureen. "And your wife is pregnant."
"It's spring and it's 8:30, said Patrick. "It's quite balmy and I don't think the baby will mind."
"And I'm not his wife," said Ellen.
There was an uncomfortable silence.
"Yet," she amended hastily. "I mean, obviously, I will be."
"Off you go, then." Maureen gave Patrick and Ellen a swift, searching look, a specialist appraising their relationship for hairline cracks that might cause trouble. Then she rearranged her face and said,
"After you come back, George and I might duck out for a game of tennis in the moonlight."
"Oh, my wife is so sarcastic," said George. "Here, darling, I've got the iron for you."
He held up the miniature iron from the Monopoly set.
"You know perfectly well I always have the battleship."
Maureen sat down at the head of the table and rattled the dice in her cupped hands.
"Come on, Jack. Don't think I'm going easy on you because of one broken bone."
Patrick was right. The wind had dropped and it felt good to walk onto the deserted beach in their jackets and scarves. The sand was still orange from the dust, but the salty cold air seemed dust-free, and they both took big, bracing breaths before tramping straight down toward the hard sand close to the water. They walked side by side without touching. Ellen concentrated on the rhythmic, hollow sound of the waves crashing on the beach and her own breathing.
"So," said Patrick finally.
"So."
"So that threw me for a six."
"Jack?"
"Yes, I mean, I thought the fact that he never asked for Saskia was a good thing. It never occurred to me that he blamed himself for her leaving." His voice cracked. "Poor little tacker."
Ellen had noticed that in times of stress, Patrick spoke more like his father, the language of Australia in the 1950s.
"Children think they're the center of the universe," said Ellen. "That's why they blame themselves."
"I think," said Patrick, "that he's been angry with me about Saskia for years."
"It's possible."
Ellen stopped herself from saying anything more. He needed to work this out for himself. They walked in silence for a few minutes, and then Patrick said quietly,
"She was a good mother to him. She..."
His words drifted away, and he looked up to the stars as if for inspiration. Then he took a deep breath and began to speak quickly without looking at her, as if there were secret agents who had met on a beach and he only had limited time to brief her on this urgent information.
"When Colleen died, I didn't cope very well. I never felt that sort of pain before. It scared the crap out of me. I thought, what's this? This hurts. So my brilliant strategy was to resist it. I remember thinking, I'm not going through that 7 stages of grieving bullshit. If it hurts to think about her, then don't. Get busy. That's why I started the business. I thought if I tried hard enough, if I was mentally strong enough, I could avoid the pain. So that worked out really well, as you can imagine. I was a walking, talking, breathing robot. But people thought I was coping great. They complimented me, and it was sort of true. I was coping. And then I met Saskia at that conference and, you know, I liked her. Probably even loved her in my weird, robotic way. But she didn't seem to notice I was a robot. We'd be doing stuff and she'd be smiling at me, and every now and then I'd think, in a sort of surprised way, she's really happy. She's not putting it on. She's genuinely happy. And I thought, well, it doesn't matter because this is who I am now. And Jack's happy. Watch your feet there. A wave had broken farther in than the others, and white, foamy water rushed toward them. Patrick used one arm to lift Ellen briefly in the air, saving her shoes before depositing her back onto the dry sand. The sudden, unexpected warmth of his body filled Ellen with a strange yearning for him, as if they weren't in a relationship, as if she was taking a walk with a non-available man who was just a friend. "Saskia took on so much of the parenting," said Patrick. "I blame Colleen for that." "Pardon?" said Ellen, confused, but somewhat happy to hear poor Colleen blamed for anything. "Colleen was a great mother, but she was very much, this is my territory. She was so condescending whenever I tried to help with Jack, as if I was an adorable buffoon, as if he wasn't really completely safe with me. So when she died, I was terrified, thinking, I can't bring up this kid on my own. I'll dress him the wrong way. He'll be too cold or too hot, and I won't feed him right or buy the right nappy cream or whatever. I had no idea, and my mother and Colleen's mother were over all the time, taking care of him. And of course they were even worse than Colleen, as if no man was capable of changing a nappy. And then I met Saskia, and she seemed so happy to step right into Colleen's place, to take on the mummy role, and I let her do that. I just sat back and let it happen. Jack loved her, and she loved him. I shouldn't have done that." He glanced over at Ellen. "Although, I don't know. Maybe I'm doing it again with you, letting you make Jack's lunches."
"I like making his lunches," said Ellen carefully. She could feel the presence of all those other women in Jack's life, the grandmothers, Colleen, Saskia, gathered around her, shaking their heads at Patrick and tutting, all thinking the same thing. "You'd feed him white bread sandwiches."
"Well," said Patrick, "I guess I'm trying to find a better balance this time. Not just handing over my son and saying, here, you look after him. And when our new little baby is born, I want to be involved, right? From the beginning."
"You've got more experience with babies than me," said Ellen. Patrick shot her a grateful smile.
"That's right. I'll be the expert. I'll train you up, darling, tell you what's what."
"So you stopped being a robot?" said Ellen. "Is that why you broke up with Saskia? And are you still a robot? Am I just another Saskia?"
"One day I started crying," said Patrick, "in the car. It was the strangest thing. I cried all the way from Gordon to Mascot. And it kept happening. Each time I was alone in the car, I started crying. Sometimes I caught people staring at me at traffic lights, this grown man sobbing away at the steering wheel. It went on for weeks. And then one morning I woke up and I felt different. Like when you've been really sick and you wake up and you realize you're better. It wasn't that I felt happy so much. I just felt as if maybe happiness was possible. And I looked at Saskia lying next to me and I knew that I had to break up with her. That it was absolutely the right thing to do. That it needed to be just Jack and me for a while. It was just so blindingly clear to me. But she'd only just found out that her mother was sick, so I kept putting it off. And then her mother died."
"Yes," said Patrick.
"And then I finally told her. I think I had this stupid idea that she wouldn't be that upset, that I was almost doing her a favor because she could find someone who loved her properly. I was shocked by her reaction, and I guess I didn't take it seriously. It was like I thought, but you can't really have loved me because I haven't even been here. You know what I mean?"
"I think so," said Ellen. She was a bit breathless. The more Patrick had talked, the faster he had walked, and she'd been struggling to keep up with him.
"Sorry," said Patrick. "Let's sit down for a few moments." They walked up to the softer sand and sat down together facing the sea, their shoulders touching.
"I think that's why I kept putting off taking out the restraining order," said Patrick. "Because deep down, I knew I'd treated her badly, even though I didn't admit it, even to myself. I'd start driving toward the police station and I'd think,
Geez, the woman toilet-trained my kid. She put her career on hold so she could take care of him. I'm in debt to her. And then I'd think, oh, she has to stop eventually. I should have taken her more seriously. I should have done something straight after Noosa, as soon as I knew you were involved. When I think what could have happened last night to you or Jack or the baby... He shuddered. It might not have made any difference, said Ellen, even if you had been to the police. Patrick lifted one shoulder in a who-knows gesture. Anyway, he said, enough of Saskia. He lifted his chin and looked at the starry sky. Please, God, enough of Saskia. Yes, said Ellen, thinking of Saskia's white face and wondering what she was doing right at the moment, if she had friends or family visiting her at the hospital, and what was going on in her strange, mixed-up mind. Patrick took a deep breath. Anyway, the reason I suggested a walk was so I could talk to you about last night, and that, thing that I said, about Colleen. His tone had changed completely. He spoke stiffly and formally as if he was taking part in unfamiliar legal proceedings. All right, said Ellen. Her stomach knotted, and she found that she actually didn't want him to speak about it. Words would just tangle things up further and make them feel worse. How strange. She had always thought words were the answer to everything. After all, she treated people with nothing but words. Keep those lines of communication open. That's what she always told her clients experiencing relationship difficulties. And now she couldn't think of anything worse than talking. This must be what it was like to be a man, his heart sinking each time a woman said, "We need to talk," thinking, "Just shut up, woman," as she revealed her soul in all its naked glory when he really wanted her to keep it covered up. "The thing is," began Patrick. Ellen said, "Is that your mother?" She could just make out the figure of Maureen picking her way carefully across the sand as if watching out for landmines. "Phone call for Ellen!" Her voice, surprisingly clear, floated down the beach. "She says it's urgent!" Chapter 25 Friendship is the only cure for hatred, the only guarantee of peace. Buddhist quote on Eleanor Farrell's notice board. In the end, Tammy left at the same time as Lance and Kate. She'd invited herself along to the movies with them. It was clear that they were all three going to become friends. I'd forgotten how Tammy had that childlike ability to make instant friends. She'd done the same to me years ago. A nurse came in to see me just as they were all standing up to go. When she opened the door, everyone was laughing at something Kate had just said, and the nurse apologized and said, "I'll come back when your friends are gone." She thought I was a normal person with normal friends who were fond of me, who had rushed straight to my bedside when they'd heard I had an accident. She didn't know that Lance was someone I worked with but had never seen socially, who, to be honest, I'd never really even noticed as a person, and that his wife was a complete stranger to me, and their visiting me was really sort of odd, and that Tammy was someone I'd lost touch with for 3 years, and that none of the people there knew the truth about how I'd broken my pelvis. The really strange thing was that Lance, Kate, and Tammy seemed determined to continue this performance. They all had plans to visit me again. Helping me through my 6 weeks of forced bed rest had become a project for them. I wondered, had they all signed up for some sort of self-improvement movement, doing the rounds on the internet, random philanthropic acts? Lance was going to bring me a portable DVD player so I could finally watch the Wire series. "You've got no excuse now," he'd said, with a gentle, teasing note in his voice that made me think he possibly bizarrely liked me. Also, Kate was coming back to teach me how to knit, of all things. This had come about because Tammy had said that I should use this time to do something I'd always wanted to do but never had the time for, like learning Spanish or whatever. I said that I'd always wanted to know how to knit, which was sort of half true. It was something that I'd always said I wanted to do anyway, without really ever having the intention of doing anything about it. But as soon as I said it, Kate's eyes lit up with the same evangelical glint that Lance got when he talked about the Wire, and she was now all set to give me knitting lessons.
and it had somehow transpired that Tammy was going to live in my townhouse while I was in the hospital. Since she'd come back to Sydney, she'd been staying with her sister, who was driving her crazy, and so offering her my place had seemed the obvious thing to do. She was going to pick up clothes for me and bring them back after I had the operation on my ankle the next day. I wondered what she'd think of my home. No books or pictures or photos on the fridge. If I'd known she was coming, I would have styled it in preparation. The bottle of wine I'd been drinking and the packet of painkillers would still be sitting on the kitchen table. Apart from that, every surface was bare and extremely, weirdly clean. The fridge and pantry were filled with functional food, milk, bread, butter. No biscuits or cakes, no treats at all. She would notice how I'd changed, remark on it. She used to visit me when I was living with Patrick and tease me about my domesticity. The cut flowers arranged in vases, freshly baked biscuits always ready in the tin. Now my home looked like it belonged to an obsessive-compulsive loner, a serial killer. After I'd eaten my dinner, it was described on the docket placed on the tray as a light meal, but it was actually the most substantial meal I'd had in months. I normally ate a bowl of cereal for dinner. I put my head back against the pillow and listened to the industrious sounds of the hospital. Quick footsteps down hallways, the clunk of trolleys, voices rising and falling. Most people would have felt lonely, suddenly alone in a hospital room. But I didn't. I found the noises strangely comforting. This was my village, the village for sick, sad, broken people like me. The pain began to roll in again, and like a well-trained rat, I automatically clicked for more morphine. I wondered, as I habitually did, what Patrick and Ellen and Jack were doing right at that moment. Whether Jack's arm was giving him a lot of pain, whether Patrick had been to the police about me. But the morphine made me lazy. My wandering was idle. I had no desire to actually be there, watching them. And then my mind drifted away from them to Kate, Lance, and Tammy, and whether they'd enjoyed the movie, and if they'd gone out to that Korean restaurant they'd talked about. And I imagined Lance and Tammy doing their Baltimore drug dealer impressions while Kate rolled her eyes. I think I actually laughed out loud before I fell asleep.
"I didn't catch her name. I'm sorry," said Maureen as she handed Ellen the phone. "Sorry to interrupt your walk, but she sounds like she's crying."
"Of course, of course." Ellen took the phone nervously. "What now?" She cleared her throat. "Hello?" A woman's snuffly voice bubbled from the phone.
"Ellen, listen, I'm so sorry to call you at this time of night, but I only just found out and I had to call you straight away to tell you and to apologize for my shocking behavior yesterday. It was just inexcusable."
The voice was familiar, but Ellen couldn't place it. Someone with a bad cold. She'd seen someone with a bad cold just recently. Who was it?
"I'm not sure." "I'm pregnant, Ellen."
"Louisa!" Ellen thought back to Louisa's furious, pale face as she demanded her money back. In hindsight, it was obvious. Of course she was pregnant. She'd had that particular washed-out look about her that Ellen had seen on her own face in the bathroom mirror. It was just that Louisa had been so angry about not being pregnant that Ellen hadn't recognized it.
"My doctor had been trying to call me. We were meant to be starting our next round of IVF, and my doctor called and said, 'You can't start this cycle.' And I said, 'What's the problem?' And she said, 'The problem is you're pregnant. A natural pregnancy, after all these years. And it's all due to you. You got me pregnant.'"
"I think your husband might have something to do with it," said Ellen.
"I can't believe I asked you for my money back. I'm horrified by my behavior. I was crazy with jealousy and, I don't know, just crazy."
She lowered her voice slightly.
"Also, I don't know if you know, but the Daily News is writing a story about you."
"Yes," said Ellen. "I know."
"I'm so, so sorry, but I ran into Ian Roman when I was leaving your place, and maybe he intimidated me a bit or I was sort of starstruck. Well, I'm just looking for excuses for my inexcusable behavior, really. He gave my details to a journalist, and she interviewed me, and now I'm just sick about the things that I said. I've left her about 30 messages trying to withdraw my comments. If it's too late and this story appears, you'll have to sue me. I'm serious. It's the only answer. Sue me for every penny I've got. I haven't got that many pennies, but you sue me for them. I deserve it.
She paused and her voice became muffled as she spoke to someone else.
But it's true. I deserve it.
It seemed like Louise's husband wasn't quite so keen on being sued.
I think I've managed to get the story stopped for a few days, said Ellen. Oh, thank God. Well, when the journalist calls me back, I'm going to set her straight. I'm going to tell her that you're a miracle worker.
Please don't tell her that, said Ellen. Seriously.
Well, I'm just going to tell her the truth. This is a miracle baby. Oh, sorry, Ellen. I've got to go. My parents have just arrived. But thank you. Seriously. And once again, my deepest, deepest apologies.
Her voice skidded up with delight.
Dad, I can't drink champagne.
Ellen heard a man's voice say,
Well, Grandpa sure can.
Congratulations, she said. Congratulations to all of you. But Louisa had already put the phone down. She inhaled, exhaled. She got a bit teary thinking about the grandpa-to-be with a bottle of champagne. Oh, God, it was still early days. If she was getting the credit for Louisa's pregnancy, would she get the blame if something went wrong? But still, her professional reputation appeared to be safe for a few more days. She went back into the dining room. Patrick was leaning over his mother's chair, following the progress of the Monopoly game, while his father marched his token around the board, shaking his head dolefully.
Pay up, pay up, shouted Jack. Triple the rent.
I think you've bankrupted him, darling, said Maureen hopefully.
Does that mean we're done?
Everything okay? Patrick looked at Ellen.
It's good, said Ellen.
Tell you later.
Hand over the cash, dude.
Jack held his palm out to his grandfather. It's late. We probably should wrap this game up soon, said Patrick.
But you said I was having the day off school tomorrow, protested Jack.
Yes, but the point was so you could rest.
I slept all day, said Jack.
He did appear to be bursting with good health now, his eyes bright and clear.
He's full of beans, said Maureen, but you two look exhausted. Why don't you let him stay with us tonight?
I don't know, said Patrick. After last night, I'd rather...
We'll take him to McDonald's for breakfast as a special treat,
said Maureen casually. She concentrated on rattling the dice in her cupped hands.
Yes, said Jack. Hash browns!
Mum, said Patrick, but Ellen could see he didn't have the energy to argue. Her own mother would be up against a formidable adversary in the battle for ruling Grandma. An hour later, Ellen and Patrick had the place to themselves. But instead of sleeping, they were eating their way through a bag of marshmallows and playing the Dragon Blade Chronicles on Jack's PlayStation. Since having a stepson, she'd done quite a lot of ninja fighting. You're getting pretty good, said Patrick, after he defeated her for the fifth time. For a lentil-eating hippie girl.
It's strangely addictive, said Ellen.
And actually, lentils are not my favorite legume.
Like what?
Just shut up and eat your marshmallows. They sat silently for a few seconds, chewing. Finally, Patrick cleared his throat and said carefully,
Okay, enough is enough. We still haven't got to the main item on the agenda.
Just forget about it, said Ellen. Honestly, let's play another game. She picked up the console. Patrick took it from her and put it back on the coffee table. Is that the first time I've said anything like that under hypnosis?
Yes.
It's just that you once said to me that hypnotherapy was completely consensual, said Patrick. That no hypnotist could make you do or say anything that you didn't want. And I certainly did not want to say that in front of you. Maybe your subconscious wanted to tell me, thought Ellen. Well, this is where it gets messy because I'm not just your therapist, I'm your partner, she said in her professional voice. I don't normally lie in bed with my clients. She gave a horrible fake little laugh, but Patrick wasn't smiling. I think you were probably half asleep, half in a trance. Anyway, it really doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter? Of course it matters, said Patrick. What a thing for you to hear. And the thing is, it gives you a completely skewed idea of how I do feel, and ever since you told me, I've been struggling to think of the right way to put this.
It's okay, murmured Ellen. If she hadn't compromised her professional integrity so badly, this horribly awkward conversation would never have had to take place.
Have you ever had any doubts about this relationship? Ever compared me to one of your previous exes? Ever had a thought cross your mind that you wouldn't want me to know?
I don't know, I guess, she squirmed. Throughout the course of their relationship, there had been a whole plethora of thoughts and feelings that she wouldn't want him to know about.
What about that day after we visited Colleen's parents and I was being a bastard? Did you think to yourself, geez, what have I got myself into here?
I don't really remember.
She remembered how she'd relived the weekend in the mountains with John the whole way home. Of course you had moments of doubt. You probably felt like strangling me when I left those boxes in the hallway, but the thing is, you don't say every single thought that crosses your mind out loud.
Yes, said Ellen. His eyes held hers. She looked away. I mean, no. A feeling of misery swept over her. All day she'd been waiting for him to deny what he'd said, to somehow explain it away, and even though she wouldn't have believed him, she'd been perfectly prepared to begin the process of deluding herself. Now she just had to grin and bear it. Her husband would always be looking at her and wishing she was his first wife.
I understand, she began bravely. You do not, said Patrick.
Oh, okay.
You think love is black and white. All women think that. And they're wrong.
Women are really intelligent except for when they're being really stupid.
She punched him quite hard on the arm.
Ow! Look, I'm still not saying this right.
He chewed on the inside of his mouth with an expression that was so frustrated it was almost anguished.
It's all right.
She rubbed his arm where she'd punched him.
I do understand.
Have I been talking too much about Colleen lately? Said Patrick abruptly.
Ellen shrugged and smiled.
I'm sorry. He picked up her hand. She's been on my mind ever since we got engaged and you told me about the baby. It's because I felt so happy, even with Saskia still hanging about. I haven't felt this happy since Colleen was pregnant with Jack. And that's made me think about her, remembering things.
He ran his thumb over her knuckles.
Colleen told me I'd fall in love again and have more babies, and I said I wouldn't. I said I'd never be happy again. But I am. Sometimes I think, actually, this is better than it ever was with Colleen. It's deeper. It's more grown up. It's just better. Then I thank God and the internet that I met you. And then I feel bad for Colleen because it's like I'm thinking, thank God she died.
Right. She wasn't sure if she believed him or if he just wanted to make her feel better.
I'm not sure if you believe me, but it's the truth. Don't you ever have thoughts that totally contradict each other? Isn't it possible to feel one thing one day and the opposite the next?
I guess, well, yes. She really wasn't enjoying this role. It was mildly humiliating. She was the one who was meant to ask the wise questions, to gently lead the less emotionally intelligent to new insights. And the stupid thing is, when I have those thoughts, I feel like I should make up for it to Colleen by remembering all the good times I had with her, as penance. So the better it is with you, the more I think about her. Does that make sense? I don't know. Maybe it's a Catholic thing.
No, that makes sense. Anyway, obviously I do not spend my days comparing you and Colleen, like you're in some sort of permanent ninja fighting contest. To be honest, most of the time my thoughts are pretty superficial, like, I feel like lamb chops, or how can I beat Jack to level 4 on Tomb Raiders, that sort of thing.
Ellen picked up 2 marshmallows and squished them together between her fingertips.
When Colleen died, everyone started talking about her as if she were a saint. People put on these mournful faces as if our marriage had been amazing, as if we never had a fight. And I think I bought into that. I was younger, everything was simpler. So I guess that's why I said what I said last night. Of course I'll never love another woman the way I loved Colleen, because I'll never be 18 and falling in love for the first time again. But that doesn't mean I'm not in love with you. And exactly the same thing applies in reverse. I never loved Colleen the way I love you. Ellen suddenly, unexpectedly yawned, and Patrick laughed.
Aren't I meant to be the one yawning while you talk on about your feelings?
Anyway, the bottom line is that I love you with all my heart. Not in a half-hearted, second-best way. I love you, and all I can do is spend the rest of my life proving that to you. Do you get that, my crazy hypnotist? He put his hand to the back of her head and kissed her hard, as if they were saying goodbye at a railway station and he was going off to war. A deeply peaceful feeling surged through her veins. It wasn't so much what he'd said, but the two lines of fierce concentration between his eyes the whole time he was speaking made it seem as if it really, really mattered that she understood. Or maybe it was just because she was so very, very sleepy, and Louisa was pregnant, and the newspaper article wasn't running. I think I get it, she said when they came up for air.
Thank God, because I don't think I've ever talked about feeling so much in my entire life as I have over the last 2 hours.
He handed her a marshmallow.
See? The last marshmallow. That's love. Now let's go to bed.
Chapter 26. Enrique Peñalosa, the former mayor of Bogota, Colombia, believed that we should strive to create cities of joy. His objective was to create urban infrastructure with one objective: happiness. As town planners, can we plan for happiness? Are we planning for happiness? Quote from a speaker at a seminar attended by Saskia Brown following the death of her mother. Plan for happiness, she wrote in her notebook. It was a warm Saturday afternoon, 2 weeks after the accident, or event, or whatever you want to call it. I'd been moved to a new room adjoining a courtyard where they sometimes wheeled me out for some fresh air. I could smell jasmine and the possibility of summer. The surgery on my ankle had gone well, according to the doctors, and my pelvis fracture was healing as expected. No more morphine clicker, just ordinary pain relief doled out in little plastic cups. Lance's wife, Kate, sat on the visitor's chair next to me. We were both knitting. She'd been twice before to give me lessons, refusing to accept any money for the wool or the new needles she'd bought especially for me. My first project was to be a scarlet beanie with a big white pom-pom on top. It was for me. The thought had crossed my mind to knit something for Jack, or even for Patrick's mother, Maureen, because she'd once knitted me a beret. An apology gift, I thought. Something to say goodbye. It would be a nice gesture. But as soon as I thought of it, I saw an image in my head of a huge oak door, like something you'd see on a medieval castle. The door slammed shut in my face. Kate said I was a natural knitter. I didn't understand why she was being so kind to me. She didn't seem like a do-gooder, as my mother used to call certain ladies from our church, the ones with saintly smiles who dropped off casseroles and bags of second-hand clothes, but were always too busy being charitable to other needy folk to accept Mum's offer of a cup of tea. I've always blamed those women for my godlessness. I liked Kate. She was a tiny bit odd. Not eccentric, just a bit off-kilter. She always spoke a beat too late or too soon, and she dropped things a lot. She was friendly, but not in that look-at-me-demonstrating-my-excellent-social-skills way. I felt strangely comfortable with her. She told me that after we'd met at the Christmas party last year, she'd been telling Lance to invite me over for dinner one night. But Lance was too shy. She and Lance had only been in Sydney for a year.
We're on the hunt for new friends, said Kate.
See, now that you're trapped in your bed, you can't get away from me. I'm stalking you.
I laughed a bit too loudly at that. Kate cleared her throat and we fell silent. I listened to the gentle clack-clack of our knitting needles and the muted busy sounds of the hospital that had become the backdrop of my life.
Speaking of making new friends, Tammy and I did a yoga class on the weekend, said Kate suddenly. I picked her up from your place.
I know, I said. She told me. Tammy had been coming in every few days, bringing books and DVDs, takeaway food and gossip about our old circle of friends that she was rejoining. I enjoyed seeing her, but I was always tired after she left. Kate's visits were somehow more restful. Maybe it was the knitting.
"Is that weird," said Kate, "that I've been to your house without you there?"
It was a bit weird, but I didn't really care.
"Of course not," I said.
"I was a bit worried you might feel like I'm stealing your friend," said Kate in her odd, almost childlike way. I realized what made her odd was her honesty. She didn't seem to filter her comments. She was a bit like the hypnotist.
"Tammy and I have been out of touch for years," I said to Kate. "She's up for grabs."
Kate smiled. "When you're back on your feet, we could all three go to yoga. We had coffee afterward at this cafe that makes the best chocolate mud cake I've ever had in my entire life. It brought tears to my eyes, it was that good."
I didn't say anything.